I'd like to welcome back to the program a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari. Good to have you back again.
It's good to be here, Mark.
You are Iranian-born, correct?
Correct.
And how long ago did your family move to the United States?
Well, we left right after the Iranian Revolution. I'm an Assyrian Christian, of course, and there was going to be no future for us in Iran, so it was the best decision for my dad to move the family here. I had an opportunity to serve 20 years in the U.S. military forces, which is something that Iran would not have allowed a Christian Assyrian probably to do.
And when we're talking about everything that's been going on here with Iran, maybe from an inside perspective as to the mindset, first time I think when we were talking, it was about the drone, U.S. drone that was shot down. The president decided not to take any military action on that drone, instead ramp up the sanctions against Iran. Because at the last minute he thought, this is according to the reports, he said, was anybody hurt? Was anybody killed? No, nobody was. Well, he decided then not to take an action that would take other lives, which I agree with. I agree with him. Is that the right step, though, too? Or did it embolden Iran to think that, well, if the United States didn't do anything about us shooting down this drone, maybe they won't do anything about us striking the Saudi Arabian oil refineries?
Hey, you know, Mark, in 2015, I had actually Near East had talked about this. We had written about who speaks for Islam, who should speak for Islam. Going back to 2015, this is an internal fight between Sunni and Shia Islam as to who's going to be the lead. Saudi Arabia has not shown its ability or capacity to be able to be the lead of Islam, and Iran is proving that on the battlefield. We cannot go and fight the wars for Saudi Arabia. We tried to do that in Yemen. Saudi Arabia started using massive bombing campaigns against civilian targets, and we ended up getting the blame. Reality with the drone strikes against the oil fields, it shows the vulnerability of how drones can be used in combat. When I was during the Mosul clearing operations in Iraq, that was one of the lessons learned that my company took, and we shared it with the Ramus Challenge, which is conducted in Thailand, training the global capabilities for explosive ordnance and SWAT, and we knew that type of a tool was going to be used. As far as the attacks against oil fields and the fight that we have against China with the oil prices going up, it actually puts more pressure on China than it does on the United States. So either way, it's actually the strike should not have happened against Saudi Arabia, but it hasn't had a negative effect against us. Getting involved in a larger conflict on behalf of Saudi would be a negative for us. So I think that this is where Saudi needs to step up. If it's truly saying that I'm an ally of Israel, I'm an ally of the United States, then you need to take some action. Your homeland was attacked. You need to be able to retaliate against Iran.
It's called talk. You can talk the talk, but walk the walk here too. And I know there are many people that agree with you, and especially since now we are the number one provider of natural gas and oil around the world. Many people ask, why should we get involved with a regional conflict in the Middle East? Well, some people say, well, you need to for national security, even though we don't rely on the oil as much as we used to. From the Middle East, it's still an ally. So how do you come down?
Well, as long as it's an ally, Mark, it still put pressure against China. And actually, it helps us out in this deal that we're trying to pressure China economically. Higher oil prices has more effects internally on China. China's been really suffering economically because of all of these maturations. One of the main ways that we kind of measured what China's ability is as far as it can sustain itself economically is the price of pork in China, because it has skyrocketed. Price of oil has skyrocketed, which added to it. With us not sending soybeans and corn to China and this drone attack that took place against these oil fields, it really ratchets up that pressure with the Chinese government to try to finally come to the table for a better deal for the U.S.
Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel as far as the tariffs against China goes, especially for how they hurt the farmers here, especially here in Iowa? Iowa's the number one hog-producing and you know, pork-producing state in the union. And soybeans, you know, we have ethanol here too, but we're talking about the two main products of, you know, corn, soybeans, and pork. Are they going to see some relief coming up soon on that? Or, you know, I know they're trying to open up new markets instead of just concentrating on China, your other Asian markets in particular.
Well, to develop those markets, it will take some time because the mechanisms have still not been put in place. Unfortunately, sometimes you get a force system, and this is what we call a forcing function with what President Trump has taking his first steps. The middle class in China revolves around how much pork it consumes, middle class and business class. And the fact that they actually, in their dialogue, measure how successful you are as a businessman by how much pork you consume on a daily basis, it is actually in their culture. And the fact that they're not consuming as much, it has completely affected their business class, middle class. That is the only way you can pressure a governmental change in China where you have new leadership come in, replacing the current leadership that is negotiating it with us. And I think once that happens, that takes place with a new contract, much better for the U.S. What is currently being seen as a loss for those farmers will be probably doubled in what they would get back, if not tripled, by the fact that those markets will open up again. The culture of China will not change in the fact that their business class and middle class is dependent on pork consumption for the measurement of their wealth. So I think if they're patient, the farmers are, they're going to probably see a much better deal strategically for the U.S. and for themselves as we continue to develop other markets for those farmers.
Are they going to be pressuring? I mean, what kind of pressure can they put on a communist regime in China? We see what's going on in Hong Kong, in the demonstrations and the riots that have been taking place in Hong Kong. They're not very happy about the idea of China being able to extricate somebody from Hong Kong and take them to China to stand trial. Hong Kong has been a thorn in China's side, too. But it's also been a shining jewel to say, look at what's possible with you.
Well, it is, but we have to go back to when Hong Kong initially became an opening door for the West. The Chinese leadership under the communist government realized a long time ago that, you know, one day this government may not be able to sustain itself, and we may want to be able to build wealth somewhere else. So a lot of the Chinese leadership going back decades realized that if we can launder our money or the wealth that China has through Hong Kong into the U.S., at least we'll have an ability to one day our family members or others be able to retire in the United States. So you had government officials in China that were literally had control of the government company. They had slave labor that was building items for them. Under the concept that they're helping the state capability, they were able to establish their business sites through China with U.S. and Western businesses and literally laundered a lot of the wealth that China had out through Hong Kong. The problem is a lot of that wealth is no longer in China. It's actually sunk costs. It's lost to them, and it sits in the United States. So as China starts cracking down on corruption with those individuals, it doesn't know how to change the system parameters to maybe find another way of being able to develop itself. So it's really kind of stuck when it comes to Hong Kong being a main money laundering capability for it. China will eventually get into Hong Kong, but you've seen the words from the Hong Kong residents now that they're not willing to even die when China enters Hong Kong. As soon as they enter Hong Kong, Senator Rubio has already put on the pilot that we're going to probably designate Hong Kong as nothing more than another city through legislative action in Congress. And if that happens and Hong Kong does not get some of the measures that other Chinese cities do, China will not win this fight. They don't have the system in place in order to be able to win an economic fight against the United States. because of that, if we just show some patience and we pressure them, eventually you're going to see a change to where China would have to come to the table and understand that if you want to be the second largest economy in the world, you have to be able to act like the second largest economy in the world. And your job is now you have to share the burden of developing the nations around you. You cannot just come in and bully your way through the process thinking that I'm going to go ahead and take control of territory and people will be willing to do what I tell them because of the fact that I have a dictatorship on the region. It just doesn't work that way.
My guest is U.S. Army, Iranian-born American soldier, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari. You were at a conference in Israel here back in the beginning of September, and it was about International Institute for Counterterrorism, 19th Annual International Conference and World Summit on Counterterrorism. So what is the steps going forward? What are the steps going forward, in particular with Iran or in any of the unrest in the Middle East?
You know, I think we have a misnomer about Iran. Iran takes steps that maybe do not make sense to us, but it is really steps that are geared towards the protection of the regime. Iran, from day one, has seen itself as having the entire world against it. And that's the type of a mentality it has. That's why it takes some of the steps it does. Iran has a large footprint through its Hezbollah and other proxies going through South America, into Lebanon, into Iraq, is tied to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, ability with China. It's just in a geographic location. It's very viable. And it has an ability that the Arab Sunni states do not have, which it can actually create Shia movements within those Arab states that are more tied to supporting the Iran-Shia concept, Iranians being Persians, not Semitic, being Aryans, than the Arab states have. And it's been proven for the past 40 years as Iran has marched all the way into Lebanon to put pressure against our ally, the only democracy in the region, which is Israel.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say they continue to sponsor. They are the largest state sponsor of terrorism around, through Hezbollah or other terrorist organizations. They supply the hardware and the knowledge through their advisory capacity with these terrorist organizations. Would you ever see a day where they stop that and want to become part of a bigger world economy?
They know that they can be part of a bigger world economy. They understand that the bazaar will be open to them. But Iran has a capacity that other Sunni states don't. Look, Iran does it for survival of the regime, and it does it to be a player on the global stage. What you see from ISIS, Al-Qaeda, that has nothing to do with a state requirement to preserve a state capacity. They are a global jihadist concept that wants to bring the end of the world so that this prophet can show up on the face of this earth and, however, maybe settle the who's supposed to be the lead, in this case be an Islamic global jihad. Iran doesn't think that way. It's very practical as to what it wants to achieve, and it will use terror to achieve that.
The 13th
now, if
Imam.
Iran knows that it doesn't have to use terror to achieve that goal, then it will use other means.
No, it's the 13th Imam, right, that you're talking about?
Well, it is the 12th Imam that has been lost, but he will come back again.
Okay.
But that's the concept that exists in the mentality of the Sunni Sunnis that are behind ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Iran uses terror as a practical means to expand its effects globally. And if Iran thinks it doesn't need to do that, it won't do it. Look, Iran has stopped developing the bomb capability when Gaddafi decided to give up his weapons. But once Gaddafi was killed, Iran realized that, you know what, there's no guarantees. We need to start developing the weapon capability, and we need to start expanding our footprint when it comes to terror.
All right.
It uses its proxies to help the regime survive. Whoever from the regime comes to the table and strikes a deal with the West again, we will we will be able to strike a deal with them because Iran has done it in the past. It's had a cross from the Western nations and negotiate a nuclear deal. The Sunni states are not capable of doing what Iran did. ISIS and Al-Qaeda are not interested in that. However, Hezbollah will do what Iran tells them to do for the survival of the regime in Tehran.
My guest has been Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, U.S. Army retired. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you filling in here at the last minute and talking to us a little bit more about what's going on in the Middle East.
I hope it helps as information and as a matter of how the strategic thinkers muddle through all that information to be able to get a resolution at the table in the end of the day.
All right. Very good. Thank you, sir. Thank you for your time and being here on Drive Time Live with me.
Thank you very much.